From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Paul Ryan is rallying support today for the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, even as Republicans face growing criticism from Democrats and members of their own party. Today, Ryan called the Republican bill a conservative wish list.
Look at what this bill does. It repeals Obamacare's taxes. That's $1 trillion in tax relief for families that will help them with the cost of health care. It repeals Obamacare's spending, Medicaid expansion, and the Obamacare subsidies. It repeals the Obamacare mandates on individuals and businesses. It ends the funding for Planned Parenthood and sends that money to community health centers, which there are more of. It has a Medicaid per capita block grant. That's the biggest entitlement reform anyone here has seen.
And those changes to Medicaid are emerging as a key issue. Dylan Scott joins us now to talk about them. He's Washington correspondent for our partners at the health publication Stat. Hi, Dylan.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And remind us first how Medicaid works now and how it's funded.
So there are two pieces of it. There is the big Medicaid program that existed before Obamacare. It covers about 70 million people. And the way it works is low-income people, and there are different rules for different states, but generally speaking, low-income people are covered by the program. The states administer it, but the federal government contributes a significant amount of the funding, usually more than 50%, to help pay for the care for those people. What Obamacare did was it expanded the eligibility of so it made more people eligible to enroll in the program. Now, originally, that was supposed to be mandatory, but the Supreme Court decided that it had to be optional. Nonetheless, about 30 states have decided to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, and more than 10 million people have been covered that way. So it's a big program targeted towards low-income Americans, and it's become even bigger under Obamacare.
And the bill that the House Republicans put out yesterday, which they're calling the American Health Care Act, would put a cap on federal spending on Medicaid, which doesn't exist right now. What would that look like?
That's right. So the way Medicaid works now is the federal government's commitment to pay is open-ended. If you're eligible for the program and if you're receiving care that's covered by the program, the federal government will pay as much as it takes to cover your care, and the states are obligated to pay a certain percentage match of that federal funding. What Republicans want to do is they want to put a hard spending cap on how much the federal government would pay for Medicaid, and it would be based on the number of people that are enrolled in the program. They do try to account for the fact that some people cost more to cover than others. You'd get more money for the blind and disabled, for example. But it would institute for the first time a hard spending cap on the federal commitment to Medicaid. And what analysis have typically shown, we're still waiting for an official analysis of this particular plan. But in the past, because this is an idea that's been out there for a long time, the analysis have shown that over the long term, that would probably lead to spending cuts and fewer people being covered by the program and less generous benefits for those who are.
And meantime, this bill would also roll back the Medicaid expansion that you were talking about as part of the Affordable Care Act, but not immediately. How would that work under this plan?
That's right. So this is also a politically tricky problem for Republicans, because in those 30 states that have expanded Medicaid, a fair number of them have Republican senators, and the senators don't want their constituents to lose their health coverage right away. So what the Republican plan would do is start to phase out the Medicaid expansion starting in 2020. It would freeze enrollment, and it would start to phase down. Medicaid expansion was actually funded even more generously than the traditional Medicaid program. So it would start to decrease the federal funding for this expansion population, though it wouldn't be automatically kick people off. What it would do is you could continue to be covered by Medicaid expansion, but only if you were constantly enrolled in the program. If you went for more than a month without, if you had a big boost in your income and you were no longer eligible for more than a month, but then fell back into the Medicaid expansion eligibility range, you would not be able to be covered by the program again. So over time, people would start up to fall off. Enrollment would presumably go down, which is, why they say that it would ultimately end up ending the expansion.
So, Dylan, of all of the things in this bill, and there are a lot and we're still going through them, how important is this issue of Medicaid expansion in terms of whether it's going to pass or not?
I think it's the fundamental question, because the margin for error for Republicans in the Senate is very slim. They have 52 members. In order to pass this bill, they have to get 50 votes. And we already saw on Monday, there were four Republican senators who said that earlier versions of the House plan to overhaul Medicaid expansion was not acceptable to them. They basically said that they would oppose it. And so as long as there's that size of a group of senators who are opposed to the Medicaid provisions in this bill, it's impossible for it to pass in the Senate. And so clearly, House Republicans are trying to figure out a way to appease those Senate Republicans and at least assure them your constituents aren't going to be immediately kicked off of coverage.
That's Dylan Scott, Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT. Dylan, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the bidding process to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border is expected to begin soon. Homeland Security is asking companies to submit designs for prototypes, and the government is looking for something very specific, a barrier 30 feet tall made of precast concrete resistant to tampering. The public radio show Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX has mapped the entire 2,000-mile border. It found that about 650 miles already have some sort of barrier, including about 55 miles of fencing through the Rio Grande Valley in southeast Texas. But there's one area where there is no wall, and the reason why could slow down the president's ambitious plan. Reveal's Michael Corey explains.
We're driving into Los Ebonos with Aurora Mirta Flores Trigo. She's a 67-year-old who lives just outside town. She warns me to watch my speed.
See, here you have to stay at 45.
Here's why. The streets are crawling with the U.S. Border Patrol's white and green trucks. And then there's the state police cars. A couple hundred feet above us floats an aerostat. That's a small surveillance blimp tethered to the ground.
Another blimp. Apparently, Thursday is blimp day.
If you saw this in a city, you'd think some kind of major raid was brewing. Here, it's just another morning.
Los Ebonos is a very, very small little village. Most of the pioneers are all gone.
But many of Aurora's relatives have stayed here. As we drive by, she points out their houses.
This cousin is mine, and this is my brother here. He's also in the list.
The list she's talking about was on a Justice Department document that showed up in her mailbox in January. It told her the federal government was suing 58 people and her extended family. That's how eminent domain works. The government sues you to force the sale of the property.
It's farther a little down. It's going to be through here, yes, right here. Yeah.
We turn off on a dirt road so we can get closer to the 16 acres the family's owned for over a century. The government doesn't want all the land, but it wants to build a section of the border fence on a one-acre swath right through the middle.
These people from wherever they're from, they don't know what this land means to the family.
Hundreds of other people do know what Aurora's family faces. In other border states, the feds already owned most of the land where they built the fence. But in South Texas, many landowners have lived here for generations. So the government had to sue. We looked up court records from all the eminent domain suits the Department of Justice filed against landowners. In South Texas alone, it filed about 320 cases in the last decade. Since the late 1990s, the government has spent at least $40 million on land for the border fence. Here's the bottom line. If the government wants your property, eventually it will take it. But some landowners hold out as long as they can, including Aurora's cousin, Alida Flores Garcia.
Los Ebonos will shine tonight. Los Ebonos will shine. When the moon goes up and the sun goes down, Los Ebonos will shine. That was my mother's little verse.
10 years ago, the federal government tried to build a fence on Alida's property, but she held out. And eventually, the government walked away. It's unclear whether the Trump administration will try again. If it does,
the majority of my land is going to be on the other side.
The barrier would cut Alida off from most of her 30 acres, including her favorite spot, a little riverside beach with shiny sand.
And I just park along the riverbeds and I just listen to the radio. I hear the sound of the trees and the smell of the water, and it's so relaxing.
It is nice on the river. But all that surveillance is in Los Ebonos for a reason.
I'll be honest, we did have the drugs coming in. We did have illegal immigrants coming in, but with no danger.
They're just passing through, she says, and they don't bother her. She's much more worried about the idea of a wall on her property. And all that ground and air surveillance that outsiders find kind of creepy, She loves it.
Technology has really helped our little town here. Feet on the ground has also helped us a lot. And I would rather give my taxpayers' money to something like that than to a wall that if the river hits it, I don't think it's going to be there anymore.
The Rio Grande twists and turns here and surrounds Los Ebenos on three sides. When the river floods, as it did in 2010, the village turns into an island. And that risk of flooding is what ultimately chased the government away, and not just because it might destroy the fence. Any flooding that spills into Mexico along the Rio Grande violates an international treaty. It's one reason previous administrations gave up trying to build a border fence here.
As I said, as a river gives, the river takes away.
For Here and Now, I'm Michael Corey.
And Michael is with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And check out, you can link to his international interactive map of the fences along the U.S.-Mexico border at herenow.org. Tomorrow, we'll look at another international barrier that President Trump speaks highly of.
Do walls work? Just ask Israel. They work.
We'll ask. Tomorrow, we'll look at Israel's walls and their effectiveness. You may know Gish Jen's work. She's the American writer born of Chinese immigrant parents who came to the U.S. in the 1940s. And that informs her writing about a multicultural America, books like 1991's Typical American and 2004's The Love Wife. But more recently, Gish Jen has turned her eye on nonfiction explorations of the East-West divide she straddles. Her 2013 book, Tiger Writing, looked at East-West differences in art and architecture. And she's now expanded on that in her new book, The Girl at the Baggage Claim, explaining the East-West culture gap. And Gish Jen joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And you know, I thought at the outset, when you set up certain ways of characterizing East and West cultures, I thought, whoa, you can get into, you know, dangerous territory here because there are cultural truths, but there are also stereotypes, you know,
absolutely,
misunderstandings we have. So, you know, many Americans grew up viewing the Japanese, the Chinese, as people who would just walk in lockstep, whereas Americans were, you know, John Wayne. That's the stereotype. But
right,
what were you trying to say about what are some real cultural differences?
Well, the fact of the matter is there are differences. There are underlying cultural differences. Now, in the West, we see those differences and we see them through our lens, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we see a self which is different and then we say, oh, they're robots and they're sheep. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to say is, yes, you are looking at something which is not you, but you are not looking at robots and you are not looking at sheep.
And they may not be looking at Americans who are just individuals who don't care about anyone else. I mean, there's sort of a two-way mirror here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. They look at us. They think we're unbelievably cold and unfeeling. You know, they look at the way we treat our elderly. You know, they think that we're really not as human as they are.
Right. So you come up with these descriptions. I love the ones for Americans. They, the more individualistic, are like avocados with big pits in the middle. So we're, you know, we're all about our big pit
right,
in the middle.
Our sacred pit.
Right. Asians are the flexi self. They're more concerned with ties to family and country. You mentioned taking care of the elderly. You begin your book with the story of a girl who arrives from China. She's the girl at the baggage claim in the title. She's supposed to be studying at a prestigious school. She has great grades, test scores. But the people, the Americans meeting her, find out she is not the girl they were corresponding with. They are not her test scores. That's not her resume. And yet they're stunned because no one on the Chinese end seems to be bothered by that.
And of course, when I heard the story, of course, you know, I share their shock in the sense that, you know, this is definitely not okay.
Well,
right?
It's fraud.
It's fraud. It's absolutely not okay. But the kind of fraud it was, do you know what I mean? The foreignness of the fraud. I felt like, you know, actually, I can tell you a little bit about how it is that the idea of substituting one person for another, which is so taboo in the West. Mm. How is it that that is, you know, I wouldn't say it's okay in the East, but it's just much more common. It's something like, you know, if you hear somebody was over the speed limit when they were driving, well, we all know that the speed limit is 65, and how is it that some people go 75 and, you know, it's not the end of the world, right? Well, how is it that they look at things like substituting one person for another a little bit the way that we look at the speed laws? You know, the flexi self sees itself as kind of part of a group, as part of a team. You know, just as the team, if, you know, your shortstop is out, you know, your first baseman might kind of move into that role. Of course, each individual is different from the next individual, but the question is how emphasizes that, you know, how much importance do we attach to that? And we here in the West, we attach enormous importance to that, but they don't.
Well, and, you know, again, we're talking about the flexi self, which
exactly
is your name for the Asian.
But you pick up this thought with copying an artwork or copying ideas is
right.
far more respected in China, for instance, than it would be here, which
absolutely.
Which answers some questions about why you could have, is it Alibaba that you speak of?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as much innovating an idea. It's about how do you get an idea that's already there and put it out? And that kind of explains some of the copyright infringement.
Absolutely. You know, we have developed this idea, right, that we have this thing, the self.
Yeah.
Well, what if you never really had that idea? You know, what if you grew up on Confucius and Buddhism? You know, what if you had a completely idea, different idea?
And what would that mean, Confucius?
Well, for one thing, instead of feeling like the source of everything which is the most true comes from the self, which is what we believe, what if you thought that everything that is the most true comes from society? Mm-hmm. And so your idea is that first and foremost, before you add anything to this great tradition, you must absorb. Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, you know, copying is not such a bad thing. And let me just sort of say, you know, so a lot of the sort of Eastern ideas about education that include copying, that include a memorization, for us, they're taboo because those things, they're not coming from within, right? So mm-hmm. we don't like that.
They're just rote.
We see it as rote. And the fact of the matter is, if we were memorizing, we would probably memorize in quite a rote way. But actually, in the East, when they're memorizing, it's not the same activity. They are not just memorizing in a rote way. They are internalizing. Mm-hmm. And so copying has been, you know, you can understand that, you know, Song Dynasty, you know, emperors, everybody copied. The copying tradition is a tradition that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And really, when you elect to copy someone, it is a mark of tremendous respect. And every painter learns to paint this way. People learn to write this way. And once you have absorbed the great tradition, then you can add to it. Well, now, I'm not defending, you know, the copyright infringement. I'm a writer, you know. I'm in favor of copyright laws. But you can sort of see that if you come from that kind of tradition, the whole idea that you would be expected never to copy and that the idea that copying is taboo is just a very, very strange idea. And you can understand that that's how the West works. But foundationally, it is not your culture.
Well, you are at heart a fiction writer. So
yes.
How do you – I mean, when you're creating characters and when you're – how are you applying it? I mean, can you give us a couple of examples where, you know, there is the stereotype and the expectation, but you have this insight into what the culture is and you might flesh that out in a character?
Well, honestly, when I'm writing, I'm just writing. If you ask me later, I might say, well, you know, I understand that this particular conflict is there because someone is coming from one culture and they're coming to a culture where things are read differently.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, yeah, I can an example would be there's a nanny in my novel, The Love Wife. She's coming from the mainland. And this family, you know, is very welcoming. And they give her an apartment over the garage. And by doing that, they mean to allow her to have some privacy, mm-hmm. right, so that she has her own place. But she feels that she is treated as an outsider from the beginning and that she is not treated as a family member and that she has basically been exiled to this apartment over the garage. And, you know, and things go downhill from there.
Meanwhile, a Westerner might die for the apartment over the garage to have the privacy,
absolutely.
Their own bathroom.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Their own bathroom. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they would not feel that they were being held at arm's length. And they would not feel that was a cold gesture. They would feel it was a considerate gesture.
Fascinating. We've just touched the surface of this, Gishgen. But I want to mention one aspect that you share. You got in trouble for writing from your flexi self. You write many commentaries, and you wrote one for the Boston Globe about what the Red Sox World Series victory in 2013 meant to the city still reeling from the Boston bombings. And you just touched in a, you know, kind of a sidebar on Jahar Zanayev, one of the bombers, the younger one, full disclosure, you and I both knew him or knew of him from, you know, being in this area. And you wondered from your flexi self point of view, gee, what happened to him? What formed this? And you were excoriated for that.
Yeah, absolutely. But I stand by the question. I mean, I think that because the flexi self is more oriented towards society, you know, and there's a perceptual difference, by the way. So, you know, if you have a lion in a savanna, you know, the flexi self will see the savanna and will also tend to look to the savanna as a source of explanations for things.
This, by the way, is real research that's been done. A photograph
absolutely.
Of a lion on a savanna.
Absolutely.
The Westerner sees the lion and the Easterner sees the savannah and asks.
Yeah, savannah and its relationship to the lion.
Right.
But it sees all these things in relationship to each other. And also when it tends to sort of, you know, to what does it attribute, you know, a given event. And over again, you will see a Westerner say, oh, it's because of the pit of the lion. And an Easterner will say, it's because of the environment. So, you know, along the same lines, when I look at Jahar Tsarnaev, I could not help but ask the savannah question. Is he just a bad person with a bad pit? Or, you know, was there something in his environment that could have changed? Was there something we could have done?
People didn't want to hear that.
They didn't. Well, this is the big pit thing, you know, is they want to hear that he is a lion and the problem lies with his pit. That is often true in many circumstances, but we have to admit that there is the possibility that sometimes the problem is not with the pit of the lion. Sometimes the problem is with the savannah. And, you know, to me, it is a very reasonable thing to raise that question. And I would raise it again. And God help me for saying this on the air. I hope they don't come after me and my agent and my publisher and everyone attached to me all over again.
Yeah. That's Gisjen. Her book is The Girl at the Baggage Claim, explaining the East-West culture gap and how Easterners and Westerners have a very different view of the world. And sometimes we get it, as I gestured toward you, Gish, combined in one person.
Absolutely. Yeah. And many people have both in them. You know, really, in these two cells, let me say, they lie along the spectrum. You know, in describing these two cells, we're describing the ends of the spectrum, right? Yeah. And by the way, very much influenced by the circumstances. So in one circumstance, they might find themselves toward one end of the spectrum. And another circumstance, they might find themselves toward the other end of the spectrum. You know, ourselves are nowhere near as stable as we imagine them.
Well, again, The Girl at the Baggage Claim, explaining the East-West culture gap. Gish, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, remember the picture of the lone Chinese protester in front of the Tiananmen Square tanks? Westerners thought he was a brave individual. Gish writes, Easterners noted he climbed the tanks to try to talk sense to the soldiers, his fellow countrymen. Very flexy of him. Your thoughts on her sense of the East-West cultural divide. Welcome at hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. So, we know you like podcasts because you're listening to one, but all this month we want to ask you to go a step further and share the love. Find someone who has never downloaded a podcast, or maybe someone who doesn't even know they exist, and tell them about one that they'll enjoy. You'll be opening up an entirely new world to them. Whether it's this podcast or another, we'd love to know what you are recommending, so tell us with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
And there are rallies around the world today on this International Women's Day. There are also protests. After a call from the people behind January's Women's March in Washington for a day without women, a day to show the value of women at work by asking them to stay home or wear red in support of women who do stay home, Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. And Maggie, we know this was inspired by last month's Day Without an Immigrant. Restaurants closed because immigrants are so important. Today, some schools are closed. North Carolina, New York, Virginia, not enough teachers. But there are also some questions about whether lower-income women who really need attention to equal pay or paid leave can afford to take this day off. So tell us more about what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely tension that's going to come out of this. All change creates tension, but that's sort of the point, isn't it? To sort of highlight the important role women play in keeping the economy going and the fact that not all of us acknowledge all the places it touches our lives and the right to point out that it's more painful for hourly workers or women on lower incomes. But that's why it's important to fight for equal pay. And also why I talked to Sally Krawcheck this morning. She's a very famous former Wall Street executive and founder of Elevest. And she says one of the keys to true equality is financial freedom, financial literacy, control your money, understand it, invest early, and that's, you know, will help lift everybody. So these are important things to discuss.
Okay, and they are being discussed where you are on Wall Street. Yesterday, State Street Global Advisors installed this temporary statue of a determined little girl. She's got her hands on her hips. She's facing off with the iconic Wall Street bull. We'll have a picture at herenow.org. But you spoke with the firm's Deputy Chief Investment Officer, Lori Heinel, who explained issue she wants to call attention to in the boardroom.
Literally one in four companies in the Russell 3000 has no woman on their boards, and nearly 60% have fewer than 15% of women. So this is a real issue in terms of having the diversity needed to make good decisions.
Maggie, it's going to take more than a day of protest to fix that, but that's something for Wall Street.
It certainly is. And talk about a powerful visual. I mean, this is getting a huge amount of attention. And in fact, what's viral now is a little girl dressed up as a superhero facing that girl, facing the bull. And it's important. Listen, this is a big change because not only are they backing the statue, but they are putting their $3 trillion in assets that they manage, all of the companies, those stocks, on notice, saying, listen, we will vote against you, boards, if you do not get some diversity, get women on your boards. And Lori said it, diverse boards make better decisions and get better returns. That's what they're all about. And they're going to push with that very important shareholder power. So that is a big change.
Well, there's also a new report. We want to get this in. It's out today about pay equity and how it might be achieved for women sooner than thought. And there are three things that need to happen. What are they?
Right. Julie Sweet from Accenture. Digital fluency, online banking, participating in digital communities, understanding how to use technologies. One, choosing majors or studies that lead to higher pay. You got to know that right from the outside. And career strategy, find mentors, push for early leadership roles. One thing that was shocking, Robin, is she said 84% of young women graduating college do not think that there is a pay gap or they think it'll be gone in 20 years. That is not true. So the more they understand this, the more they get involved early and advocate for themselves, the better chance we have to close that.
Well, it may not be gone in 20, but it may be gone in like 40.
If we keep working on it, it will. It will.
Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. She's back with us once again. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And let's get right to some of the music that you wanted us to hear. This is the Danish singer-songwriter Agnes Obel with Mary.
Have I?
Very interesting, very almost cinematic. I could see that as the opening sequence for a movie or something.
Well, funnily enough, I interviewed her for KCRW, and that was my first question. Hmm. And she actually said no. She loved the fact that that, you know, first came to mind. But what she really did with the album, she told me, it's called Citizen of Glass, is she got the name first, and then she, it was a concept album, basically. She went with the name.
Hmm. And tell us more about her, Agnes Obel. And by the way, her name is spelled as if it were Agnes Obel, but she likes to say Agnes Obel.
Yes, well, she's Danish, and she lives in Berlin now, and we discussed Berlin and what a creative community there is there in visual arts and music, and she's really embraced it and stayed there to make her music, and she really does it all on her own. She recorded and mixed this album by herself, and back to the Citizen of Glass, she actually read an article in a German magazine about surveillance, and they use the term Citizen of Glass, meaning that we are transparent and we can be seen. Everything can be seen.
All right, well, let's get to the next one. This is new music from Ryan Adams. This is To Be Without You.
So hard to be without you. Lying in the bed, you got so much to be without. Rattles in my head, that empty drum, no doubt. And everything you lose. Night is lonesome and is longer than before. Nothing really matters anymore.
Now, Ryan Adams told the British music site NME that this album is, quote, directly related to his recent divorce from actress Mandy Moore. He said it reflects what was going on inside me. What do you hear?
I hear the exact same thing. I hear devastation. In fact, I don't think Ryan has made this devastating of an album since Heartbreaker, which was a number of years ago. This is actually his 16th album. And I've had the pleasure, actually, of watching Ryan Adams. I spent my early years in music in North Carolina when he had a group there called Whiskey Town. We were from the same place. And I used to go see him all the time. And what I hear in him now is this embracing of the emotions and then wanting to share them in a very, very mature way.
Hmm. And this is his first album since covering Taylor Swift's 1989 album in 2015. What has he been doing?
Well, you know, he caught a lot of stuff for the album 1989, the Taylor Swift cover album you were talking about. But that was really happening sort of right when the whole divorce thing was happening. And now it seems that he's ready actually to address his feelings. And he's very open about it. That's what I love about Ryan Adams. He doesn't hold it back. He puts it all out there and is happy to talk about it.
And this song in particular sounds like it's from a previous era in a way.
Yeah, it does have that. And maybe he's going back to a comfortable place in addition to putting himself out there. I have no idea, but that's what it feels like.
All right, well, up next, we have another American musician. This one mysteriously disappeared in the 70s. This is Connie Converse and Playboy of the Western World.
I knew a man once very long ago. They say that he was born in Buffalo, but I don't believe it. Buffalo was never sufficiently gilded and pearled, and this man turned out to be the playboy of the Western world. Oh, he was elegant, past all dreaming. He made seeming seem like the real McCoy.
Okay, so I left people hanging there a little bit on Connie Converse. Why don't you tell us, first of all, the story of what happened with her?
Well, what happened was she was an incredibly precocious student from New Hampshire, really wanted to go to New York and be a writer. There, she taught herself to play guitar. She did some writing. And so she started making some music. A couple of people recognized her talent. And she had sort of a glimmer of something when she appeared, or a glimmer of fame, I guess, when she appeared on, I think it was with Walter Cronkite on one of the morning shows. And next thing you know, she's moving to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where her brother was. Yeah, she right around, and she did that right in her late 30s, and then right around her 50th birthday, she got in her car and drove away, and nobody's ever heard from her again. Hmm. And I know, it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and this song that we're listening to was done when?
It was done back in the 50s. By the way, I have to give giant props to Howard Fishman from The New Yorker. I actually read about her back in November in The New Yorker. He, the writer, discovered her back in 2009, and I think he got together with some people. They've actually put out some of her music, and I do believe there's even more coming from her, but he became obsessed with her, and it's a beautiful piece in The New Yorker.
Have you gotten any reaction when you play her on the air in KCRW?
Yes. Here's the thing that gets me about her is, yes, we know her backstory, and this was recorded in the 50s, and she, you know, drove away and never to be seen again. But there's also something to me very modern about her. The reaction I'm getting is people want to know who this new singer-songwriter is, who's doing things in a retro way. But what she's talking about is super relevant now. And that's been the most surprising thing to me about Connie Converse.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and this is the Cuban singer Daime Arocena. This is Mambo Nama. Tell us about this one.
Well, she's from Cuba, and she started studying music at the age of 9, classical music. And she, as a young girl, was singing Giles Peterson. You know Giles Peterson from the BBC? A really wonderful DJ.
Yes, in fact,
producer.
He did a DJ session.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, yeah. My gosh. I'll have to go check out what he picked. So Giles Peterson, he started working on this series called Havana Cultura, and he went to Cuba and actually heard her. And at the time, from what I read, she was too young even to participate, but he was blown away by her voice. So when he went back to do the Havana Cultura kind of remix, he introduced her and her Cuban music heritage to electronic music. And now she collaborated with an LA artist called Dexter Story, who has recorded a lot of East African music. Miguel Atwood Ferguson, who is a legendary in Los Angeles too, did all the string arrangements for this album. So it's got a distinctly American meets Afropop meets Cuban legacy meets really the modern world.
And right now is such an interesting time in Cuba because of how much change there is at the moment. Do you hear a lot of music coming out of Cuba right now?
Well, I think we're starting to. That's one of the things that I think has put this record on everybody's radar right now, is that now that there's this sort of new open relationship with Cuba, a lot of these artists, whom I'm guessing have been there singing, we're going to hear a ton more coming out of Cuba. This is just scratching the surface.
Ann Litt, DJ at KCRW. And thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Arkansas lawmakers are considering a bill that would ban from public schools books written by the late historian Howard Zinn. Zinn was best known for his best-selling alternative history, 1980's A People's History of the United States. It's credited with changing historical writing, telling stories previously untold about war resistors, labor organizers, Native Americans. Nathaniel Bacon's Uprising of the Poor in 1676 makes an appearance. It showed that in the colonies, class lines were already forming. Zinn was a Boston University professor. He died in 2010 at 87. After inspiring legions, including Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, he was their neighbor growing up. They celebrated his work in the film Good Will Hunting.
You want to read a real history book, read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That book will knock you on your ass.
And the book became a bestseller again. We spoke with Howard Zinn in 2008 after a graphic novel version of his People's History was released. We talked about many things, including the ongoing Iraq War.
It is very important for young people to see the persistence of deception. To understand, it's not just this war. It's a long historic fact, this fact of deception of the people getting them into war.
We'll have our whole conversation with Howard Zinn at hereandnow.org as we bring in Adam Kirby, who'd like his social studies class at Little Rock Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, to consider the works of Howard Zinn. Adam is one of hundreds of teachers and librarians in Arkansas who oppose the bill that would ban Zinn's books. Hundreds are writing the Zinn Education Project, asking for copies of Zinn books for their classroom. And Adam, you've also written the sponsor of this bill, opposing the bill. On what grounds?
Well, I do believe that education is ultimately about creating critical minds. And I like just that clip you played of Howard Zinn. He's talking about us processing a long and complex history. And our role is to expose young people to as many voices as they can be exposed to. And when you begin to limit a voice, you begin to limit perspective. And when you limit that perspective, you really do create a society that's not excel in critical thinking.
Well, his People's History has been required reading in most schools for years. It was just stunning when it first came out. Columbia University professor Eric Foner said it was one of the first integrated accounts, including the idea that Thomas Jefferson had slaves. It talked about the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, the suppression of the Philippine independence movement, things that had not appeared in history books. There was much applause. There were also detractors. Harvard University historian Oscar Handlin wrote in the American Scholar, "The deranged quality of this fairy tale in which the incidents are made to fit the legend, no matter how intractable the evidence of American history." So he has his critics.
He does have critics. That's part of the dialogue that has to continue. I would not say that we should just read Howard Zinn. I'd say we need to read everybody. I've been teaching 14 years. And the students I see today, as opposed to the ones I saw starting out, they have been surrounded by the internet and technology from day one. They don't have a memory where they don't have a smartphone in their hand. They have access to more information than I could have ever imagined at their age. And so as an educator, it's my job, it's my responsibility to help them see the depth and the breadth of what's going on in the world. And if that's, you know, showing them some Howard Zinn, if that's showing them someone who would critique that idea, then that's my responsibility. And if state legislators or politicians begin to tell public school teachers what they can and cannot put in front of students, I think that really harms our society, which is based on an advanced citizenry reading, thinking critically, and pushing forward with ideas.
Well, the state rep, a Republican, Kim Hendren, who introduced the bill, said his constituents were concerned about some of the approaches Howard Zinn takes to history, and that he, Hendren, has no problem with students reading it, but it's parents who need to be responsible for that. Your thought?
I'm a parent, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand the push of some parents to say, well, let me determine what my child can and cannot learn. And I hear that complaint loud and clear. I would respectfully just add to that. When you begin to think, and I said this in my letter to Hendren, that if you think of our history as a child growing up, America as a child, and we're growing up, we have warts, we have flaws, we have things that need to be addressed. My child is the apple of my eye. I love my daughter. She's wonderful. But to believe that she is flawless, then that's, in my opinion, that is just not the kind of parent that is empowering their child to be successful. I want to see my child wrestle with not only her imperfections, but with the imperfections of our country, because we can always improve.
That's Adam Kirby. He teaches ninth grade social studies at Little Rock Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he is opposing a bill being considered by legislators in the state that would ban the books of historian Howard Zinn. Adam, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And here's how Howard Zinn once put it. My history describes the inspiring struggle of those who fought slavery and racism, like Fannie Lou Hamer, the labor organizers who led strikes for the rights of working people, like Mother Jones, those who've protested war, like Harlan Keller. My hero is not Teddy Roosevelt, who loved war and congratulated a general after the massacre of Filipinos, but Mark Twain, who denounced that massacre. Your thoughts on Zinn's book being banned are welcome at herenow.org, where again we'll have our interview with him. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.